Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I hope you've all had a great day. This is an open line show, so if you'd like to call in, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. If you need a toll-free line, the number is toll-free, area code 855-346-3351. That's 855-346-3351. I'm also attempting to set up the chat room, and hopefully that will work, but it seems to be going a little slow, so I'll try to relaunch it. So today I was... There was a post on George Ebert's wall that I said that I would be talking about tonight, and this is an article called Spark for a Stagnant Search in the New York Times Science section, a $650 million donation for psychiatric research. This article was written by Carl Zimmer and Benedict Carey. Came out today, July 21st, and yeah, so Stanley is giving, Theodore Stanley is giving, how are we doing this here? Ted Stanley, yeah, is giving $650 million donation for psychiatric research. And I don't even know what to say. If you'd like to call in and talk about this, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167. I mean, $650 million is just a phenomenal amount of money. And the way that it's been broken out is that it's a commitment to the Stanley Center at the Broad Institute. And its quote-unquote aims is to galvanize mental illness research. July 22nd, 2014, this was published, and of course today is July 22nd. That article came out yesterday. Sorry, I don't know what day it is. Okay, so at www.broadinstitute.org/news/5896 is an article by Broad Communications. That there is this commitment of $650 million to the Stanley Center at the Broad Institute. So it reads, the Broad Institute today announced an unprecedented commitment of $650 million from philanthropist Ted Stanley aimed at galvanizing scientific research on psychiatric disorders and bringing new treatments based on molecular understanding to hundreds of millions of people around the world. The Stanley commitment, the largest ever in psychiatric research and among the largest for scientific research in general, will support research by a collaborative network of researchers within the Stanley Center for Psychiatric Research at the Broad Institute, a biomedical research institution that brings together faculty from MIT, Harvard University, the Harvard-affiliated hospitals, and collaborators worldwide. Stanley's commitment to the support the work of the Broad Institute will constitute of an annual gift during his lifetime, followed by a bequest with a total current value exceeding $650 million. Taking prior gifts into account, Stanley's philanthropy and support of the Broad Institute's work totals more than $825 million. If you're interested in talking about any of this, the number to call in is area code 267-521-0167, or you can call in toll-free 855-346-3351. Hello. 202, your line is open.
Well, if with $600 million, if they can't find a... I mean, this is such a waste of money. But if they can't find something after $600 million, I think the nail is on the coffin. $600 million. What could we do with $600 million? I mean, that would be about $10 million for every state and territory. For support services for people that are having emotional distress.
Could you only imagine?
That's all I got to say about that. That's a lot of money.
It is so much money, and it is such a dangerous game that's being played here. And if people don't see this, that on the Broad Institute, I think it was on the Broad Institute's website, there was a link that went to show the players inside of this. And so the link on is from Broad Institute is called Shared Vision, Three Lives Converge to Revitalize Mental Health Research. So they're putting all of this on three people. Ted Stanley, a, quote, visionary philanthropist. Skolnick, who they're calling a visionary scientist. And Hyman, who they're calling a reinvigorated leader. And that the work of these three men is what is to lead the future of the country forward in finding a genetic link to quote-unquote mental illness. It's such a fraud. The entire thing that they have the audacity to be presenting this in this way and that this is such money-making thing. So at the bottom of the press release, it says, the future of psychiatric research. The Stanley Center engages a community of more than 150 scientists at the Broad Institute and its partner institutions. Over the coming years, the plan is to draw on Stanley's tremendous generosity to accomplish at least four major goals. So one, the first goal is to complete the list of all genes that play roles in severe psychiatric disorders, including schizophrenia, bipolar, autism, and others. I think that this is really important for people to realize. When you're looking at the actual researchers and the scientific community and all, they make no distinction between developmental disabilities or psychiatric disabilities or substance use. They just lump it all in the same thing. They see, even though the state departments have different offices that carry out different ways that this programming, they don't distinguish it. So that's goal one. Goal two, reveal the biological pathways in which these genes act. And goal three, and this is where I think that we really need to be very concerned, develop cellular and animal models that faithfully mimic human disorders. How? Why are we using mice? They're planning on using mice in order to mimic psychiatric disorders such as, quote-unquote, schizophrenia. How is a mouse supposed to... Can somebody please explain to me that if, like, the symptoms of, quote-unquote, schizophrenia or disorganized thinking or spiritual experience...
They say mice. I'm not reading anything into that. You know, mice's little brains are very tiny. Their habits that they have are, you and I know that they're not going to just use mice.
But even if they were just going to use mice, how are you supposed to compare a human experience to a mouse? How is, if the ways that we are looking at what is called affect, inappropriate display of affect, how are they supposed to know what the mouse is thinking or feeling? How can they in any legitimacy suggest that this is, that a mouse can be used in any kind of comparable?
Yeah, but we have to watch this very closely. I do not believe that, with this amount of money on the table, that they will not have, they will not seek volunteers to be involved in this broad study. I know I myself, at another time, we had recruited people maybe 10 years ago to to give their blood to be tested at Howard University because they were looking for the bipolar gene. So I don't think, I think this needs to be watched very closely. I think with a lot, this much money on the table, that mice are not going to be the only thing that they use.
Well, yes, I agree with you completely.
With early studies, it might be mice, but it will go up to other animals, and it will be the temptation to have human subjects will be too great. Because as you always say, there is no proof. We don't have a blood test. I mean, they maybe hope to find something on the gene, and I don't know how they're going to do that. I mean, so far, the only thing they've done is engineered drugs to have people to have diabetes, because I even have heard NIMH scientists say that the schizophrenia gene was on the same address as the gluten gene. So it's no mistake why people gain weight. It's because it's been designed that way. It's no way that they're only, with this much money on the table, that they will not be using human subjects. So we have to watch this very carefully. This may be the time for people to look into IRB training. I know the Stanley Foundation, I looked up stuff about them before. They're always available on the Internet. Stanleys are responsible for over half the research on schizophrenia and bipolar illness in the United States and Israel. I don't know why they choose Israel, but before this gift, they were. And so that means that Ted Stanley, the Stanley Foundation, TAC, and I know that they're two separate entities. They will have a lot of power because every university, every major university will be applying for this money.
Well, yeah, that's right. And with these goals of using animal models to be able to, to faithfully, animal models that faithfully mimic human disorders. I don't know how you're going to get a mouse to mimic what a human does. If they can figure out how to get a mouse to act like a human, then they really should be awarded millions of dollars. You know what I mean? Mice can't talk. Mice can't express emotions. And the idea is that they're putting out this fraud in this way. It just In 1908, I think it was, Lev Vygotsky wrote an article called The Crisis in Psychology, and he said it was two things. First, that they were using zoology as a way to define human behavior and kind of slammed the idea of using animals to determine human behavior. And then second, the idea that normal was the goal type instead of just another type, and that wasn't part of it. But the fourth goal of the Stanley $650 million minimally over time is to develop chemicals to modulate biological pathways to serve as drug leads. The researchers plan to build on the existing therapeutic efforts within the Stanley Center, I'd like to know what those are, and draw on the broad therapeutic platform, a technological powerhouse with capacity to create and screen hundreds of thousands of compounds, to identify molecules that can powerfully and precisely influence specific biological pathways relevant to psychiatric disorders. It goes on, Skolnick is quoted in his article saying, we're still at the beginning of the curve of translating the emerging genetics into actionable biology, but it's happening much faster than I thought it would. In other words, there's nothing still. But he goes on to say, I'd be bold enough to say that in 5 years, all the drug companies that got out of psychiatric research will be getting back in. The coming decades of psychiatric research will yield new science and a needed parallel effort to increase resources for services that can help patients and their families. Of course, we're not people. We're just patients. So this is more of the same, but I agree that people need to watch out.
Their hope, what are they? They're saying that their hope is that they're going to recreate. I've heard this before, is that they want to, and correct me if I'm not understanding you, they want to recreate the conditions that look like mental illness?
In mice, yeah. I'm sorry, schizophrenia, bipolar, autism, and others. Yeah. They say they develop cellular and animal models that faithfully mimic human disorders. In contrast to studying cancer or diabetes, the Broad Center, Broad Institute writes, researchers studying psychiatric disorders have been unable to identify animal models that correctly capture important biological aspects of the disorders and correctly predict which therapies will be effective in humans. Now, with growing knowledge of the genes underlying psychiatric disorders, Broad researchers plan to create cellular models in the laboratory and animal models that more faithfully match both the genetic variation and the biochemical processes seen in human patients. They plan to pioneer cutting-edge techniques such as genome editing, which allows them to precisely introduce any mutations they choose. This is just so dangerous.
That's a waste of money because, you have to think about it. That statement that they made, We should frame that because what they're saying is, look, we haven't been able to find any proof of these illnesses, so we want to try to recreate the condition so we can see how it affects the mice's genes. So they're gonna use chemicals, or they're gonna traumatize the mice?
It's entirely unclear to me. But in the New York Times article, it starts out by saying, one day in 1988, a college dropout named Jonathan Stanley was visiting New York City when he became convinced that government agents were closing in on him. He bolted and for 3 days and nights raced through the city streets and subway tunnels. His flight ended in a deli where he climbed on a plastic crate and stripped off his clothes. The police took him into a hospital, and he finally received effective treatment 2 years after getting a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. Quote, my son's life was saved, his father, Ted Stanley, said recently. When he himself was in college, he added, those drugs didn't exist. I would have had a non-functioning brain all the rest of my life.
But I met young Mr. Stanley, who was not so young, and I hope... Because
now 48. Yeah, the New York Times says Jonathan Stanley, now 48, cannot explain why he suddenly developed bipolar disorder at 19. All he knows is that his brain responded well to lithium. He was eventually able to return to college, complete law school, and become a lawyer. Quote, you're talking to a guy who went from psychotic to normal with some pills, he said. And isn't Jonathan Stanley on, like, one of the founding board members of the Treatment Advocacy Center?
I'm not sure of that, but at one time they gave them a lot of money, and you can see that through the 990. I think the son is on the, I saw him listed as one of the board of directors in one of the years. I don't know whether, I can't, see whether he's currently, because I can only go back to the years that are available publicly. And people need to know that any foundation or nonprofit, there are two places in which you can get their financial information that they post on the form. They may have additional addendums that may not be there, but you can go to the Foundation Center and go to their 990 finder, and you can look up the Stanley Foundation, Treatment Advocacy Center, NAMI, any number of organizations that are required to file a paper return. That means they would have over $75,000. And you can see who their board of directors are. You can see...
Yeah, on the Treatment Advocacy, you know, those are great resources, Yvonne, as always. But I'm just looking at the Treatment Advocacy Center, and on their current website, Jonathan Stanley is indeed a board member.
Yes, he has been for many years.
Yes.
And so are the members of Sheriff's Association. But yeah, that's what you do if you're on a board. If you serve on board, then it's expected that you get or give. So,
yeah, so $650 million. I mean, we can't find two pennies to rub together for rights, and people are being told that they're reprehensible by Murphy if they advocate on behalf of people who are caught up in psychiatric industry. But $650 million to the Broad Institute.
They feel that this is a plague. This is how they portray it, is this is a plague on the land, that DSM-5, of course, we know that all human behavior can be explained by one or more of those little things in the DSM-5 Bible. So somebody's going to be spending a lot of money, $650 million. Like I said, that's more than maybe $13 or $14 million per state. I mean, what could we do for cancer?
What could you do for communities with that kind of money? They're not interested. They're just, because it's another one of these goals that will never, ever actually come to fruition, because this is what they've been trying to do. I saw somewhere that they waited to release this information until this new research just came out that was published, that they found potentially 100 genetic links to things that are quote-unquote psychiatric. And it's such a fraud, and they're presenting it as if...
But they're not getting all this money at one time. The man has to die. I'm reading from the Boston Globe. And it says, Albert Stanley has given Broad $175 million, and the new commitment makes him the research
center. I can't understand you.
They're not getting all this money at one time. This is part of a bequest. The $650 million we provided as an annual cash flow will vary, but is in the ballpark of tens of millions each year. The remainder will be given after Stanley's death.
Right.
So they're not getting the money all at one time. So this is a huge deal, but tens of millions of dollars for research is like a drop in the bucket. But what could tens of millions of dollars do for peer respite? So if they're not getting $650 million all of a sudden, they're going to get some, looks like this is some estate planning that they don't say that, but that's what, when you have huge amounts of wealth, that's what people do. They're not going to pass it to each other because they have to pay so many taxes. So this is some kind of bequest trust that's being set up with a pledge of $650 million. Now that means a lot because
minimally that it could wind up being more than that based on how much more money Stanley makes before he.
Well, we had to make sure Stanley has to stay healthy, but. This is not that huge amount of money all at one time. They're going to get some tens of millions of dollars, and it's probably going to be. I would watch a Broad Institute and see if Stanley or some of his operatives, like Tory, become members of their board. Because with a bequest like that,
if they're already not, the board of directors,
that's why I was mentioning those other resources, because you you really have to look and see, because you can be the bequest like that can be changed unless it's put in a trust. And but you can wield a lot of influence by the fact that people believe that you're going to give that institution close to the future value of a $650 million bequest like that is going to be in billions of dollars. Because
right.
unless the man is in poor health,
Well, I mean, and quite frankly, the Broad Institute, you know, on their own webpage, they say that the, you know, that this was done with an unprecedented $400 million gift in addition to the $200 million already pledged, assuring the permanent status of the young organization. And on July 1st, 2009, the Broad Institute became a fully realized 501c3 nonprofit research organization. So this is already a well-funded machine with $600 million in its bank to begin with, minimally.
Connection to Harvard now? Is there a connection to Harvard? Is there connection to Harvard?
From their page, their founder's page, the Broad Institute was founded in 2003 and launched in 2004 through the extraordinary generosity and remarkable vision of Los Angeles-based philanthropists Eli and Edith Broad. The Broads recognized earlier than almost anyone else the inherent promise of genomics to change medicine, and they saw the need to empower scientists to work together to realize that promise. Their founding gift was intended to provide the resources necessary to allow the Institute 10 years to build and prove a new collaborative model of science focused on transforming medicine. The Boston area's preeminent biomedical research organizations, Harvard University and its affiliate hospitals, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, share the Broad's vision and join together with them as founding partners of the Broad Institute. On September 4th, 2008, Eli and Edith Broad announced that they would endow the Broad Institute with an unprecedented $400 million gift in addition to their $200 million already pledged, assuring the – yeah, so it's Harvard University, its affiliated programs, MIT, the Broad Institute, and and now Stanley joins in with it. And so this is what they were talking about before with Skolnick, Hyman, and Stanley being the three men that were going to revitalize psychiatric research in the United States and get all of those psychiatric drug companies back into doing psychiatric research. And so I think people need to be concerned about this. But if you'd like to call in and talk about this or anything else, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167. It's area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, it's area code 855-346-3351. 855-346-3351. There also was an article that came out again in the New York Times in the New York region today about Rikers, New York City reviewing Rikers assaults on 129 inmates. And this was written by Michael Schwartz and Michael Weinerup. And I'm sorry, this came out yesterday, July 21st. And so New York City's Department of Investigations has begun a review of scores of cases involving inmates at Rikers Island who were assaulted by correction officers and suffered serious injuries. The department, which combats corruption in city agencies, is looking into the 129 cases from an 11-month period in 2013 that had been detailed in an article in the New York Times last week. And so this is the injuries were the focus of a secret report completed this year by the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene and obtained by the Times, highlighting a culture of violence and in particular victimizes inmates with mental illnesses. This is the New York Times writing. The review of the cases is now part of a broader investigation that the watchdog agency has been conducting at Rikers involving violence and corruption. It's being staffed by 30 investigators, including 19 who work on the inquiry full-time. Already, 8 correction officers and a captain have been arrested and charged with assaults on inmates, contraband smuggling, and falsifying documents to cover up malfeasance. This is, you know, they're starting to take it seriously, and this is in part due to inmates who died who had psychiatric histories, including one who overheated and then one who was left in seclusion for over a week and died of a massive staph infection. And so it's nice to see that there's some action happening there and that people are taking that apart. And at the same time that we're battling this idea of looking at a growing psychiatric research industry.
Mm.
I mean, what would happen if that money went to something else? I mean, not that there's anything that any of us can do about it. But
yes, and well, one thing is to dig down deeper and to look at how the request is set up. I wonder, you know, with around the world, other people coming out and saying that, you know, that mental illness, as we've come to know in the 21st century, is like a consumer epidemic that's gone out. You know, the British Psychological Association, NIMH, has come out and said that. I mean, even the statement that you read from this article says that they can't find that. Maybe that's being fueled by people like Stanley listening to what we're saying, that there is no, you know, there is no proof that mental illness exists. There's no blood test. There's no, you can't take an X-ray. They do try to sometimes point to brain scans, but nobody is using them to monitor people. And I guess the next thing is, you know, just to go down and to look at the genes and, you know, it's like the man that comes to your house and says he wants you to come to work for him and he wants you to mine some gold, and he takes you to the place where there's gold there and there's nothing there, and they says, well, just take the wheelbarrow and whatever is here, load it up and move it to the next room and move it back and you'll get paid. This seems like this might be what happens, because if the latter century, all the research that was done, and that, you know, I know 20 years ago when I had first heard of my diagnosis, because I had gotten I was receiving treatment from the age of 7 at different times, and I had never heard of my diagnosis until 20 years ago. And if all this research has been going on this half of the last half of the last century and about the last decade, and they still haven't been able to find it, I don't know if $650 million is going to find it. It's going to make a lot. It's going to divert a lot of talented people because the money is there. And what happens is when people go to school, they want to work in research and they want to make a difference. But when someone else offers you so much money, it's going to divert a lot of talented people from research in other areas of really known illnesses. I think, you know, like Larry was on the program last night, and a lot of people there a lot of serious illnesses. Not saying that the emotional stress that you or I or anyone else has is not real, but the fact to say this is an illness, we know how to curb it, but I don't think there's a will to do that.
Yeah, and there's just such a this is just such a phenomenal amount of money, even over time, you know, that and already to an organization, an institution that already has $600 million in the bank, so to speak, to add another $650 million to it, and with the encouragement of people, that absolutely it's going to sway, because researchers research what is being paid for. So even if people want to and they're interested in looking at alternatives or any of that, they're not going to be able to do that, because all they're going to be able to get money for is this, you know, manipulation of mice that they'll then make comparisons to human experience about, which, again, is just in itself is a problem. A mouse can't speak any human language, and so... to suggest that they can somehow mimic the human experience in a mouse is and always has been ludicrous. That's just...
Well, the Broad Institute, I guess, originally the way they filed their 501c3 was they were interested in birth defects, genetic illnesses. So, and Harvard, that's the institution that has come up with this hood disease that the CDC talks about. And I would just say that you want to...
it's also the institution that, or the Harvard-affiliated programs that held Justina Pelletier.
The Institute's mission is to propel progress in biomedicine through research aimed at the understanding and treatment of disease and the dissemination of scientific knowledge for the public good.
Mm.
That's the Broad's
And of course, what is the public good is a huge question here. Area code 614, your line is open.
Hi. Yeah.
Hi.
Just listening. I'm not sure which organization you're talking about is getting the funding. That $600 million sounds like not very much, really, compared to what the pharmaceutical companies have in their coffers, though.
Well, that's close to $1 billion. If you think about it, this is a bequest.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at that, the $650 million.
But that's from a big pharma company to a grantee of some kind.
No, it's not.
To Harvard.
It's from a private fortune of a toolmaker. Ted Stanley is the founder of Stanley Tools. So it's not pharma money. It's a man who has come under the influence of people like E. Filatori and D. Jaffe. They feel very grateful. They feel as though that that pharmaceuticals and forced treatment. That's in fact, that's what Jonathan Stanley says. Well, I don't know if he says it now, but I know 10 years ago, a conversation where he says that forced intervention really helped him, because without it, nothing would happen. So these are people who really believe the opposite of what. I believe, Lauren believes, and some other,
mm-hmm.
probably of our listeners believe, they really believe that, and they want to find
I guess part of what they're doing is complaining that the pharmaceutical industries have largely pulled away from trying to find new psychiatric drugs. And your point, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, but your point is that compared to
I'm
the
Catherine.
Psychiatric...
Yeah.
Oh, is this Catherine Hine?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, hi. I didn't recognize the phone number. I was going to get to the press release just momentarily. I'm glad you called in. Thanks. In comparison to the pharmaceutical industries themselves, $600 million is just a drop right? Because these drugs are making billions of dollars a year. So this doesn't even, you know, this is like $10 to them in comparison.
Right.
But the idea that Stanley is going to go ahead and support things that ultimately things like the Treatment Advocacy Center and EFL or Tory probably will wind up benefiting from one way or the other remains a huge problem. But Catherine, thanks for so much for calling in, and I'm wondering if you would just give a short synopsis about what's going on with John for anybody who may not know anything about it, just so that the press release will make sense. And then maybe talk about where...
Yes. John has been involuntarily committed for some 5 years now, involuntarily medicated or force drugged for 3 years, three plus years since March of 2011, based on hearings in which no evidence has been presented, both hearings. Neither hearing did they present evidence. But there's going to be a pretrial, and it's for the first time going to be on the record, the court reporter and everything. And well, that there's been a record before, but not since the last round of filings that John's attorney has filed. And it's going to be public. So, you know, I think this is very important that commitment hearings of any kind be public. But I think that I think that really the state's evidence is either non-existent or flimsy. So we have a lot of hope that the correct decision will be made, that this court doesn't even have jurisdiction anymore to do anything except order John's release, because back 5 years ago, his rights were completely annihilated in the original commitment proceedings. So that July 30th, 1 o'clock, it's a Wednesday, Ross County Courthouse, Chillicothe, Ohio, 1 p.m., there will be a public pretrial in which the issues will be reviewed between the attorneys and the judge. And the judge has stated that he will now, for the first time, decide whether he still has jurisdiction, which is another way of saying he's going to decide whether or not they messed up originally and denied John his constitutional rights. If they did, and it's hard to figure out how anyone could say they didn't when they didn't introduce any evidence, then he's going to have to order him released, which will mean an end to the forced drugging. It'll be an unconditional release.
That's what we're hoping for.
And
so I'm just looking. So this judge is not the judge who was originally ordered John confined. So there's a good chance.
So there's a good chance that he
might look at this with no responsibility for his own actions and be able.
That's what we hope.
Yeah.
We have been asking for relief since December of 2013. So, you know, it's not like, you know, we've been welcomed with open arms into the courthouse, but this at least is a hopeful sign, and the judge said that he will now finally allow John to be seen by his own medical doctor on the outside. We've been battling that for almost 8 months, too.
Wow.
So we have, he gave in on that issue finally.
Do you think that they wouldn't let the medical doctor, his own medical doctor?
Nope, they wouldn't. Here's the rationale. They say, oh, well, okay, you have a right to a medical doctor. The medical doctor can go see you in the lobby. They can examine you there.
Oh, no.
Well, what's wrong? Why don't you, you know, that's your right. Go exercise it.
Well, I'm...
Yeah,
I remember this. A friend of mine died a year ago. He's 90-some years old. He was in that state hospital. And the fight tooth and nail to have him. Now, I say alarm, I'm surprised, but I'm not surprised at that. He's 90-some years old. They had to have him shackled for him to go to the hospital. And why would they would kind of circumvent this because Of course, he couldn't leave the state hospital, St. Elizabeth's, without staff. So what they would do is they would not schedule staff to go with him. So stuff would be delayed, and his physical condition would deteriorate. And I think sometimes this is done on purpose. I've seen people wherein, you know, sometimes in these, at least in a hospital where that's in my neighborhood, there are people that are in wheelchairs that shouldn't be in wheelchairs because, and one time they did have general medical doctors and they took them out of the hospital. Now I understand that they bring them back, but some of these people that are very old, the chemicals, the interventions they use make us subject to a lot of medical conditions. And I wonder is when things like this happen and someone's rights have been violated like this and that there's physical damage to their body, is there do either of you know, is there any recourse financially? I know if you were locked up in prison and they found out that you were innocent, you know, there might be some recourse. Is there any recourse if it's found?
Every state is different, but I know in Ohio they make it very difficult for not just people who've been incarcerated, but for anyone who's suing for malpractice or the related torts that go with that, assault and battery, you know, like the physician that amputates the wrong leg. The statute of limitations on those are very short, usually a year, whereas, you know, with other civil wrongs, you know, it's usually at least 2 years, sometimes 4 years. On a contract, the statute of limitations is normally about 4 or 5 years. But doctors get treated special, extra special.
It's a doctor thing. It's a doctor thing, not because the person is in a mental institution, is what you're saying?
It's a special relationship that seems to exist between physicians and legislators. And legislators create legislation that very much favors
doctors.
Like
the doc fix bill.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Like what?
The doc fix bill where they snuck in the quote-unquote assisted outpatient treatment program. You know, because the good doctors need to be paid. It was H.R. 4302, which passed and is now law.
There's other little enactments where, you know, if there's an incident that happens in a hospital, including a death, we want to encourage those doctors to talk about that in private. In private,
yeah.
Of course, and so therefore, the records of those incidents are heavily shielded with all kinds of confidentiality, because we want to encourage doctors to talk openly about their mistakes with each other.
Right.
We don't want that to be subject to subpoenas later.
Right, and that okay, yeah, absolutely, and so you know, hopefully. Judge Holzapfel, is that how you say his name?
Holzapfel.
Holzapfel. Hopefully Judge Holzapfel will decide that John needs to be immediately, unconditionally released from Appalachian Behavioral Healthcare in Athens, Ohio, where he's continuing to
be
tortured.
It would
be
a very easy decision,
right?
For him to make.
Right. So he's being forcibly injected with risperidol consta, right? And
mm-hmm.
But
yes.
if for some reason he doesn't make this easy decision and doesn't see that the fact that, like, somebody was held there and involuntarily treated in this way based on no evidence,
mm-hmm.
So if he decides that it's acceptable to conduct, you know, these types of hearings without any evidence, then what happens?
Yes. Then he has stated that he will schedule probably in September either a jury trial or a trial to the court. We have asked for a jury trial, and the Ohio Constitution guarantees the right to a jury trial in civil and criminal cases. So I don't believe that the judge or the prosecutor want a jury trial, But, you know, I think we would be entitled to one. I mean, I don't think we should go to that.
Right.
It should go to that point.
Because
but we want to get some
movement.
Then what
happens when the citizenry
finds out?
Even if the court
doesn't have jurisdiction, we'll go through the charade. You know?
Right. But what happens when people in Ohio find out that this could happen to them? They don't want this going to trial. Right? They don't want the public to really know what's happened to John.
And press something in there to be covered.
Or what's happening to him. And you know, so people are invited to come to the court hearing and show their support. And that I'm just reading here. It says briefs are being filed in the case by two human rights organizations, both the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights and the International Society for Ethical Psychology and Psychiatry.
That's right.
Yeah, and so I think that people really need to step up and if they could, I wish I could be there that day. I have something that I can't not be at, but if you're in Ohio or nearby and can get to Chillicothe, is that how you say that? How do you say that?
Chillicothe. It's about an hour drive south of Columbus on Route 35, I think. No, not 35. Oh,
what's the date?
Wednesday. It's a week from tomorrow, Wednesday the 30th at 1 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Wednesday, July 30th at 1 p.m., and I'll be putting this information out on my Facebook page and sharing the press releases. And, Catherine, people can reach you if they need more information.
Yes, that's right.
614-633-0215.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that's 614-633-0215, and I will put all of this information out. And, you know, and I think that, you know, people, just to understand that if it's my understanding, and this is in part based on Sharon Kressinger's Mad in America article that she had written, that if John refuses to be drugged, he is thrown down on the floor by multiple people and injected anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That this is a constant
assault. And beaten in the process.
Right.
There are safe ways of forcing drugs. You know, if you use enough people, I have been told this by someone who used to do this for a living, that ideally, if you're going to take someone down to the ground and force inject them, the safe way to do that is to use no fewer than six people. Otherwise, you have to really brutalize the person.
I don't know that
there's any safe way. I don't even know that that's quote unquote safe. And certainly the drug itself isn't safe, and that's an assault. And if somebody is voluntarily taking that risk on themselves, you know, do whatever you want. But to be saying that you do not want something and then having this risk imposed on you, I think Yvonne's question about is there some kind of recourse that's going to be available for him to repay?
Assault and battery are civil wrongs as well as criminal wrongs. I'm sure that we'll never get a prosecutor to prosecute them for the crimes that they have committed. But
I would look at what's going on in Rikers Island right now, with over eight correction officers and a captain have been arrested with charges of assaults on inmates, contraband smuggling, and falsifying documents to cover up malfeasance, specifically of people who had psychiatric histories. And this came out July 21st in the New York Times. That there's been a secret review of assault, and it might be a good crossover to show how that's happening. And
is that prosecution by state authorities or federal, do you know?
Well, it's my understanding that they're not wanting the DOJ in right now. The last line is, quote, federal monitors and the Department of Justice get involved when localities are unwilling or unable to fix institutional problems, he said. We are absolutely willing and able to investigate this matter. So I think it's still within local, but it's my understanding that they had a state, the investigation department, which was created in 1873 in response to the endemic municipal corruption of the Gilded Age, monitors 45 city agencies for corruption and misconduct in New York, I guess. So something they found something. So that's what's going on, but I'll send you the link, and it's in July 21st, New York Times, New York Region, and the title of the article is New York City Reviewing Rikers Assaults on 129 Inmates. And this was in part prompted by some deaths that were somebody who was left in a cell for more than 7 days in seclusion, who died from a massive staph infection, and another man who the heat in his cell went up to like 108 degrees or something like that, and he died from the heat.
One of the things that happens is in hospitals, and I've worked in two hospitals myself, in hospitals they have training for this. What you were saying is correct. And usually the reason why they have training is because they in the past had some abuse. And I think a good case can be made that the person is brutalized by pointing to the fact that they do have training that usually don't call for more than three people to do that. Because there is a way. I went through a training, but I refused to participate in those kind of things.
Right.
We didn't need it. We did rap groups. We never had to do anything like that. But they, because all the people that were coming from the outside and were coming from a peer organization had to get that training, and that's sort of like standard now in a lot of places. So I think if they have those many people, they are brutalizing the person. And they do have to, when they do that, they have to document.
Right, but it's also known, and this is part of what one of the things I'm most proud of, the DuBois research for pushing through on this, who Jim Gottstein was an external reader, by the way, so I'm excited to see the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights is putting out a brief for this, was the idea of deadly force with deadly weapons. And so a deadly force is defined as anything that causes death or serious bodily injury or is known to cause death or serious bodily injury. And so restraint ought to always be considered something that is deadly force because it is known to cause death and serious bodily injury. And then, of course, the drugs themselves, since they are known to cause death and serious bodily injury, under the definition of deadly weapons, it's included devices and substances that are known to cause death or serious bodily injury. And since restraints and drugs are known to cause death and serious bodily injury, they're deadly weapons. And so it's deadly force, survivors of deadly force by deadly weapons. And I think that we can never, ever, ever say that there is a safe way to restrain somebody or to, even though they say it, the system says it, I don't think that we can ever justify that there's any, that we can ever use that language that even, that, like, well, that's fraud that they're perpetuating, that they're saying that that's quote-unquote safe. Anyway.
That's true. I was just trying to make the point that they aren't even trying to pretend to be safe. That,
right,
for example,
right, right.
We pointed out, if you're not abusing him, and he's got the bruises with witnesses on the outside who've seen his bruises after two of the attacks, if they're not videoing that to show how non-abusive and safe their procedure is, just like the U.S. Bureau of Prisons requires for when they force feed prisoners. The Guantanamo prisoners in particular were force-fed, a brutal procedure. But at least they have the pretext, well, you know, we're trying to feed them, and they're going on a hunger strike, so whatever. But there's no even pretense here that they're trying to save his life or, you know, they're not trying to save his life.
Right.
You know, they're trying to utilize, you know, a product that they're bilking the taxpayers for.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I'm very happy to hear this this news. This sounds very promising for John, and perhaps we'll set a precedent for people who live in Ohio that this can't happen to them too. And that this is torture.
I think it's good for people to get to visit their courthouses when there's going to be, you know, really almost any kind of issue. I mean, to get familiar with what goes on, because this is where people's rights get enforced or lost most of the time. Oftentimes they get lost. And it's important to see what goes on. I think too many people have the experience, though, just ordinary people going through divorces or whatever, they actually believe what goes on at television, that they're going to go to court and they're going to get a chance to get up on that witness stand and swear to tell the truth, and they're going to get to tell their story, and they're going to be able to... And their lawyer is going to be able to catch the other people, you know, telling, you know, making false statements. But it doesn't happen that way for most people. For most people, what happens is you get to court, and your lawyer and the other person's lawyer go into a back room with the judge where there's no court reporter, there's no record of what happens, and then your lawyer comes out and tells you how it will be. And you wonder, well, whatever happened to my day in court? That was it. You just had it.
And so what a fraud that is. And so American justice, that this concept that we all have. And I think that this is, you know, I recently went to an involuntary outpatient commitment hearing in New York. And even though I've been to them before, every time I go to these things, it's the first time I'm ever seeing it, because it's another whole new way of it going about. Same kind of thing, backroom deal. But then they go through the entire thing, like they didn't already make a backroom deal, you know. So there's like an act going on throughout, and you know, how somebody is supposed to sit there. This has been my question, Catherine, because if you know, heaven forbid, I ever get into a point of where somebody does this to me, I don't know how one sits at that table straight faced, with showing the proper amount of, or quote-unquote proper amount of emotion, while the people are, you know, assigning you, quote-unquote, mentally ill. And to think that John went through all this in the last 5 years of his life without even having any evidence presented as to such, how can anybody looking directly at this situation see anything other than, this man needs to be immediately, unconditionally released?
I don't see how they can. Yeah, it seems pretty cut and dried.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there's no chance that they will make any, he'll be released out and out. There won't be any conditions or anything like that.
No one has asked for a conditional release, so it's a matter of what is before the court and what is not before the court. The only thing before the court are the motions that John's attorney has filed, and those have only been for unconditional release. They have been acting as if that there's an option for unconditional release. No. Unconditional release, in order for a court to decide something, the issue has to be before the court. It has to be presented to the court. It's never been presented. Nobody's ever raised the issue. And it's too late now. So the only issue is whether or not he's going to be unconditionally released, whether or not there's any jurisdiction to do anything but order him unconditionally released.
So that's good.
A lot of times, and this is one of the things I wanted to say the last time we were in court, a lot of times people think that, well, we need to enact new statutes and change the Constitution. You know, most states have pretty good, except for malpractice statutes, most states have pretty good legislation already. Actually, Ohio doesn't have bad legislation for commitment, but it's getting courts to observe that, those statutes.
You mean they don't follow the law?
Well, the Ohio statutes is very clear that there is to be a full hearing. There was supposed to be a full hearing with rights read, the whole nine yards, and evidence presented by clear and convincing evidence, and that didn't happen. He was read a few rights real fast. The whole thing took about 30 seconds. And they said, oh, we got a report off the side here. Y'all take a break here. Look at the report. Okay, back on the record. Yeah, I saw that report. Yeah, we're going to ship them over to, at that point, you know, the state hospital in Columbus. And anything else? No. All right. Case closed. The report that they said that they used, they never marked it and put it into evidence. Possibly we would be in a different position today if they had done that. For some reason, they didn't do that. They didn't want that report to see the light of day. And they thought that they could get away maybe with it not seeing the light of day.
It really,
so it never got into evidence.
Definitely human rights stuff, definitely.
And I'm just wondering, I mean, is anybody, because when I asked this of the lawyer at the involuntary outpatient hearing, I was told that this was political and not the place for this, but is anybody putting forward, like, that there's no evidence for any psychiatric diagnosis, or, like, is that getting entered into the evidence?
Those points are being, yeah, we've made some kind of points that way. I think tactically you have to be careful not to say that there's no such thing as mental illness. You can certainly say there's no test. There's no diagnostic test. There's no blood test. There's no any physical exam. There's no anything. You can say that, but I guess judges and other people like to hang on to the notion that, well, oh, but I've seen people. I've seen people with mental symptoms. I think people get mixed up with having mental symptoms with it somehow being a disease.
Right.
And that's real unscientific, but...
I think it's really important that the idea that there's nothing outside of a subjective evaluation of somebody's, you know, behavior and speech, you know, that there's no biological testing for any of this, and they don't know the etiology of it. Not that, you know, extreme states don't exist, but that there's no idea that.
As a strategy in court, it's not working. Is that what you're saying, right?
Well, there's the Daubert-Frye test that, you know, some case law that says, well, if you're going to introduce scientific evidence, you have to jump through certain hoops and show that it's valid and reliable and based on general consensus in the scientific community. Well, you can have a lot of consensus in the scientific community about stuff that's nonsense. But there has to be more to it than that. If you're going to, I guess there are tests out there that purport to predict violence, for example. But none of them have been found to do much better, I don't think, than a coin flip.
Right. But there's nothing. There's no legitimate test that can show any of this or. And so, like, I see that as part of the fundamental evidence to why somebody shouldn't be being able to be subject to psychiatry by court order.
There's huge evidentiary problems. Huge.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people, too, don't realize that the evidence that is used against them comes from privileged communication that... If they haven't waived that privilege, you know, it really shouldn't come into evidence. It's not only privilege, there's hearsay problems. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. Any medical record, you know, a so-called expert testifying from a medical record, he's basing his testimony then on hearsay, on stuff that got written down by some nurse one day, you know, in a record. And the nurse isn't there to take the witness stand, to be cross-examined, to see if she told the truth.
So
there's a lot of, yeah.
So what you just said about waiving, because this might be something that people aren't aware of, that you have to waive your right to your medical record? I mean, if you're being...
Yeah. That's based on your medical records. Because experts are only supposed to testify on the basis of evidence that would be admissible on its own.
So is like
I mean, there's HIPAA,
there's HIPAA protections,
of course.
Is having the so I'm a little confused because is having like the prosecuting psychiatrist or the prosecution side your psychiatrist called by the prosecution? You can waive that?
Yeah, why would anybody do that unless they just didn't know?
Well, that's what I mean. I don't think people even know that you can waive
this thing. Don't waive it, right? In other words, if you have to waive it in order for them to get the record, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
And then
unless
once
they
you
just
waive
kind of
it.
Bulldoze their way through and they just bring in the psychiatrist from the hospital and just try and put them on, if your attorney doesn't object, all kinds of inadmissible stuff can get into evidence.
Yeah, you don't have to have them. You don't have to have access to your records. They'll just have to go on what's there.
So if somebody has, say somebody doesn't know that they can refuse that and that they that's an option for them to waive the right for them to have a psychiatrist and such come up, is there any recourse for them once that's been done if there are these ongoing hearings where every 3 or 6 months people are being hauled into court?
Well, I think during those review hearings, a person can certainly object to the continued use of inadmissible evidence that's privileged, that's hearsay. They can't really do much about evidence that's already been admitted against them in the past that they didn't know to object to.
Everybody
needs to say that again because what I'm hearing is, I just want to make sure, if you don't want your...
Every state is different, of course. And some states have a lot of exceptions to whether you've been deemed to have waived the privilege. Ohio happens to have a very tight privilege statute. Doctor patient, psychologist patient.
If I was in Ohio, let's say, if I was in Ohio, and like you said, every state is different. If I was in Ohio, and for whatever reason I'm in court, maybe it's a commitment hearing, maybe it's something else, and the prosecuting attorney sends to my attorney says, look, we want to get that person's the medical records. I can just say, no, I do not waive the relationship that I have with my doctor. Is that what you're
right.
saying?
Yeah, right. You assert your right to confidentiality of your records.
Everybody needs to know this. I'm sorry if I sound like I don't know the first thing about anything, but I really feel like everybody, this is something that I don't think everybody is aware of, that they can halt this process right here and now by just saying that
I'm not saying that'll always work. I have heard stories of where that confidentiality is overrun by a court order. Well, we don't care about your privilege that you're entitled to under statute. I think that you're just incompetent to assert your privilege, so I'm going to order that privilege waived.
Right, because I think that's what's happening in New York.
Big problem with the court doing that, but I have heard of it being done.
I feel like if that's not exactly what's happening, it's what people are being told will happen, and so they're just signing over their or giving away their privacy rights.
Yeah, they're handing over their rights with both hands. Yeah, most people do.
And that's why everybody needs to have to have a little team of their own.
Well, I think that part of the problem is that this happens to everyday people who may not have ever had a second thought about psychiatry or law or court or anything, and then they're just hauled into this mess, and they don't know what they're, you know what I mean?
Yes.
They're just half the time,
exactly.
You know, we're trained to trust the doctor and trust the, but then how do you ever have, the idea that there can be some kind of quote-unquote therapeutic relationship with this person who's just testified against you in court? Like, I'm going to trust you? I'm ever going to say anything to you again? Like, please. It's such a...
Yeah.
So July 30th, huh, at 1 p.m.,
right.
At Ross County Courthouse, Chillicothe, Ohio.
In Chillicothe, Ohio.
Chillicothe. Uh-huh. Ohio.
Yeah.
And people are invited to attend and show their support for John. And, you know, John. We had a poster of John at Bastille Day, and he sat on a chair with us through 72 hours of sitting to call attention. And there's some pictures on Facebook of a poster that Sharon Kressinger had made.
I saw that.
Yeah, and so I think that, you know, people are, slowly becoming aware of his situation, and then just extending this, that this can happen to anybody, and all you have to be is in the wrong place at the wrong time, and not have your, be in a place of where, because you're psychiatrically assigned, everything else is taken as you don't have to have your rights protected like anybody else. And the idea of hearings without evidence and things not being submitted into evidence because of whatever reason is just Americans need to be aware.
I think people's representation, who are accused of being mentally ill, is significantly worse than what it would be for other people, even for criminal defendants, because there's just not training in mental illness law. I noticed that with John's case, looking at the public defender that had been assigned to him and how little he did other than to agree with the other side. They're underfunded, they're not trained. It's more difficult to represent a person in a mental illness proceeding than it is in a criminal proceeding, especially if that's all you do is criminal work. You know, you understand the rules of criminal law, but the standards are different and they're more vague in mental illness law. The burden of proof on the other side is less than what it is in a criminal case. It
seems to be nothing.
It's supposed to be by clear. In fact, the United States Supreme Court decided way back it should be no less than by clear and convincing evidence. Everybody should know. There's certain things I think everybody should know about their body, about medicine, and about law. And one of the things is in the United States, there's three burdens of proof by preponderance of the evidence, which is like 51% of the evidence. It's not exactly that way. The next highest burden is by clear and convincing evidence. That's maybe like you have to be 75% convinced. And then the other is proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard that there is in a criminal case, which is like maybe 98%. Not proof being, you know, it's not a certainty, but it's almost to a moral certainty. But it's less than that. To lock somebody up for being mentally ill takes less evidence than to lock somebody up for holding up a liquor store.
And that's why we say that the some of the pending legislation and that's occurring around the country is so dangerous, because coupled with that and the expansion of the DSM-5, almost anyone could be, in Great Britain they say sanctioned, but could be labeled and put away or be forced to do things that might be injurious to them. Because it is not the same. If you get picked up and you're mentally ill, there's a different standard, as you well illustrated, than if you're picked up by a police officer and they said that you did something wrong. They have a choice. They can either book you or release you. And with mental illness, they can hold you and during that time, they can find something where that they would be able to use in a proceeding to hold you even further than the 72 hours or a week, in the case of the woman in California that her family wasn't even allowed to see her for a week.
Right. And meanwhile, John's been locked up this way for 4.5 years, being forcibly drugged for at least 3 of them.
But hopefully on the night of the 30th, that I assume that you're either a supporter of his or the
somehow involved in the case, that you will be calling us and we'll be celebrating.
Yes, yes.
Or John himself.
I hope so. We hate to count our chickens before they're hatched, but
it seems
like the logical thing to happen.
And I believe John knows that there's an invitation to him extended to join us anytime that he's able to, but I know under the circumstances that there's been a lot of loss of things that most of us would consider just basic necessities like communication at will.
He still has some phone rights, but they've taken away his internet rights.
Yeah.
For resisting the medication.
That's one of the first things they do, because they want to keep them from having that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Keep them from having the hope on the outside.
Right.
But certainly, hopefully, John will be unconditionally released immediately after the hearing on July 30th. And if you'd like to call in or get involved in any way or anything we can do, afterwards.
He has called from time to time, and I think he's kind of shy, and and of course, you know, it's a sensitive time right now too. I mean, I think we're both a little hesitant about what we might say that might be twisted and used
after the fact. We don't want to do anything to lessen his chances for freedom. And I know how they use that. We used to have hearings. They said after we had the Department of Justice and we had a lot of lawsuits, that people had to have telephone rights. They had to have the right to have stationery and actually to have stamps. They don't have stamps, so hospital just post their letters. But I think internet is going to be something that people have to have, and I don't think there's any reason for, because that's the mode of communication now.
Yeah.
So that's
exactly
another battle that needs to be taken out. It's not right to limit people's ability to get support, especially when it's different when you, it's not any different, I know Lauren will say that, but if you're somewhere for 2 weeks versus if you're a perpetual patient. You know, if you're going to be kept for longer than 30 days, not being able to communicate with the outside world through the internet is isolation.
Well, and for John particularly, it's difficult. He's very intellectual. He has websites that he's been developing, and not just for himself but for other people too. And you know, he does a lot of writing. He does song compositions that he markets online and writes books that he markets online. So, you know, he can't do that now.
Yeah, that's former isolation. It would be the same thing if he was deaf and they didn't let him use his hands. It would be the same thing.
Yeah.
It's a cruelty. It's really a cruelty for someone like that. And I don't know why they do that. I do, because they don't want them to communicate with the outside world. But, you know, it's supposed to be a hospital, and that's supposed to be punishment. But all these things seem to be surrounded about being punished. And think about a young lady, I think I mentioned on the show a couple of times. She lives in my neighborhood. She's been at the hospital for 13 years, or maybe a little bit more than that. And they get 1 hour outside. People get 1 hour. They have privileges. And she wanted to go see her mother, and she has never had privileges to go out for a weekend or whatever else. Her mother was sick. And so I don't know why she would think she would be able to go home and come back within an hour, but she did. And so now she has no privileges whatsoever. She can't go outside. When they had older buildings, they used to take them out on the roof. I think that there must be something wrong about that, that she cannot get fresh air. Well, they do get fresh air. They got a courtyard, but it's all blocked in, much like you would have in the prison.
No, it's not outside.
Yes.
You can call it whatever you want, but, you know, it's a lockup.
Yeah.
It's a lockup. Yeah. It's a prison. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. And you're not. People will. If you think you're gonna just take people and throw away the key, it's different. But if you think people are gonna eventually get out, what kind of person are you creating? That's like that. You know, you can't hold. Well, they are holding people forever. You know, people keep telling me, Yvonne, we don't hold people like that anymore. I says, well, what about this person, that person, this person? They've been there 20 years, 30 years, whatever.
Or they release people and then they're just set up so that they will come back. So it's a revolving door.
Well, they release them. We say here that people get released
they
end up on their website. They get released to the nursing home or to death.
Yeah.
Or to a smaller institution like group home, which is and many times is more restrictive than what they win. They're more restricted in a group home than they are when they win the hospital. But I hope John gets out, and I hope that we'll be able to talk to him when he feels up to it, give hope to other people. And if other people have had this experience where they've been detained, this Lauren's show is a good place for them to come on so they can teach the rest of us, because I learned something tonight about, not giving them your evidence. Your doctor doesn't have to testify against you.
Right.
Yeah. I hope you'll both stay on. But area code 609, your line is open. Area code 609. If you're on mute, maybe unmute yourself.
It was asterisk.
Hello?
Am I on?
Yes, you're on live.
Okay, sorry. This is Jason from New Jersey.
Hey, Jason.
Hi, Lauren. Hi, Yvonne.
Hi,
buddy.
I can't really follow too much of what you guys have been saying. I've been trying to, but I'm a little distracted. But I've had this a quote on my desk that I printed out a few weeks ago or months ago that I wanted to read. Can I go ahead and read it?
Oh, yes, please. Thanks. And Jason, it's good to hear your voice. I haven't talked to you in a while.
Yeah, I've been listening.
Go ahead. Gave a call.
It's a favorite quote, but I've had it out, and because I'm just, you know, I'm pretty angry all the time now, but because I can't really live my life anymore the way I would have wanted to, but because of all the treatment I've had and everything, and I used to do a lot of art and stuff and be really involved in that way, and I don't do that anymore, but this is a quotation from you may have heard of him. His name is Antonin Artaud, and he was a French. He was an actor, and he was, I think, in the 20s, and he was in some silent films. And then later in his life, before he, I believe, he died in an institution in France, and I guess the quote is probably from around 1943, maybe 1946. He was locked up. I think for 10 years he was electroshocked, and he was held for like 10 years total. But I'll just go ahead and read it. I myself spent 9 years in an insane asylum, and I never had the obsession of suicide. But I know that each conversation with a psychiatrist every morning at the time of his visit made me want to hang myself, realizing that I would not be able to cut his throat. And I like that quote. I think if you type his name in, this is one of the quotes that will come up, you know, famous quotes or whatever. And I think I actually came across the quote in reading from Foucault somewhere. It was in there. And, you know, and I was thinking about it, so I looked it up one day, and I wanted to read it online. But I guess that's all, really. And, you know, and I think he killed himself I think he committed suicide in an institution. He eventually just drugged himself to death. But he did, before he died and after he was shocked and everything, he made a whole bunch of art. And I do have one of his books. And
what was his name again? I didn't catch it the first time.
Antonin Artaud, A-R-T-A-U-D. And he was he looked like he was about 80 or 90 years old, but he was only, I think, about maybe in his 40s, and he just was, you know, just 10 years in an institution, just ravaged, and but he did make a lot of good writings. He did writing. He was sort of a surrealist, or he knew people who were. He traveled in those kind of circles, and he did a lot of notebooks, and he did a lot of writing, if anyone's interested in people who've been psychiatrized, and you know, it's just his attitude just is. You know, I think it echoes. I mean, it's the same attitude as some people who have been treated that way, and it's just been going on for so long. I mean, nothing has really changed. You know,
and now
it just feels like things are really closing in and getting worse in so many ways for so many, you know, segments of the population, not just outsiders or. You know, children and geriatric people and you know, pregnant women and everyone.
It's really, really horrible. And I'm trying to find online. Could you spell his name again, Jason?
Yeah. His last name, his first name is Antonin, A-N-T-O-N-I-N, and his last name is A-R-T-A-U-D, Artaud.
Got it.
Yeah.
And you know, it's interesting. I'm looking at here the Theater of Cruelty. Fabulous. And anyone who dies from self because of their experiences with psychiatry is just a brutal shame and crime. But as far back as 1855, in a book written by Phoebe Davis, who had been institutionalized at the Utica State Lunatic Asylum, she wrote that of the doctors, I would be fine if I saw them swinging off. You know, and so the way that they, the anger that is generated based on the experiences that we have with them persists sometimes for years, and something that people, you know, if you're out there listening to this and you're experiencing this, that this is a feeling, and that there are ways to move through it, you know. And I think that don't end in one taking their own life. But this again was something that we were talking about yesterday, also. And so, to anyone out there listening, know that you're not alone. And there are many of us who feel this way, and that, you know, to get connected with people who have had similar experiences and such. And, you know, I'm just looking here through some of his work. And
Theater of Cruelty, I don't know when he came up with those series, but I think I'm not sure what he came out of. World War One. I think he may have, you know, he was around during World War One, and then I don't, you know, he wrote a lot of, I think he, you know, he wrote about theater and wrote, I'm not sure if he was just an actor, he may have written some plays and had his own ideas about art and what it was, what it had become or what. And that was,
really, it looks like a really fascinating person to look into, and I thank you for, you know, opening my eyes to his work, and that this is part of what even what Seth Farber was talking about the other night,
mm-hmm.
That the breakdown and that there's a breakthrough if people aren't drugged out of it and limited in these ways, and then when one's rights are taken away and even without a, like what's happening with John, to not even have a true defense in any way, and then to just be forcibly injected. And Jason, some of the things that you've survived also, I just think it's so important that people know that that there's ways out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
we need to tell
our stories about these things because it's unfortunate that it continues to happen. And I'm quite sure in Nazi Germany that in the 30s and in the early 40s that some people probably didn't, even though they saw the boxcars going by, they say they didn't know. And
yeah.
That's you have to continue to tell, because people, just like a lady was saying, that people don't know their rights.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know that there's a difference, that we're all U.S. citizens, but there's that hyphenated name that's there. And we got to tell our stories. I was wondering, some people that are online, I have I would like to get people to put some of their stories on my blog. And if people are interested into a larger forum other than Facebook, there is Mind Freedom. But if they want to send an email to recovery2000@gmail.com and ask to have an invitation so that they can post their writings on the blog, I would be happy to do so.
Would you give that address out
mm-hmm.
again?
recovery2000@gmail.com. That's the email. And if you want to have a place to put something larger than a tweet or a Facebook thing, I would be happy to entertain that. And especially some of the information tonight and other places. Sometimes it's too much to put in a it's too much to put on a Facebook or whatever, just like when you were talking about the things we don't know when we go to court, different other people in history and how it's affected them. A lot of people don't realize Paul Robeson was a great singer and activist. He was a person who was a subject to electroshock treatment. He regretted it all his life. But we need to... make sure we can expand on these things. And
I think that's great. And there's also on the DVoiced page, dvoiced.org/your-evidence.html, is a place where people can catalog the experiences of abuse and torture that they've experienced also. And so, Yvonne, would you give up that address again for your blog?
Well, it's the Recovery 2000 at blogspot.com. But if you want to, what I'll do is give you permission so you can put things on there. If you would send to the email address of recovery2000@gmail.com. And what way a blogger thing works is I can even give a person a specific, after a while, a specific email address, and you can just send things from your email. So you don't have to have a specific knowledge to of HTML or anything to put in there. But that's recovery2000@gmail.com. That's my email address. Just say you'd like to be a contributor to the blog. And I'll send you a link so that you can see it and see if you want to be a part of it. And the other one was DVoice?
It's, it's dvoice.org / your-evidence.html. And so that's evidence.html. Yeah. And so there's just a name, email, and then a space for you to put your evidence right in, and then it gets sent right into the computer and gets organized. And that's one of the pages out of the DVoice research that we've been trying to get up to let people know, because we are collecting and then hopefully putting this kind of information together for shadow reports to the United Nations and stuff like that, we're going to be having special shows on talking about what exactly that is and how people can get involved with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we need to do some more stuff like that. And one thing about a web page or a blog, people can still, once stuff is put up, just like Larry Drain has that Hope Community Works, his blog on WordPress for larger discussion, and then you can follow up and link them on your social media. Because we really have to, there's so much stuff out here. There's so much misinformation on the Internet. I don't want to say misinformation, but there's this kind of sense that these things, like that happened to John or some other people, that, you know, well, it's, this is for these people's good. And the story about the Johns are not getting out. Just like the stories about Larry's wife, Linda. Those stories, occasionally they bubble up and national media get it, but social media is very important in getting our own narratives out about our own. I come from a tradition wherein we have, there's probably over 100 slave narratives, but we need to have more of our own narratives about our own experiences with the psychiatric system, because it shouldn't be like myself that it took 15 adult years to find out really what it's about, and that it's really about coercion and force and really a not helpful to people. You were saying something?
I was just thinking about Rocky Erickson, a musician from Texas. Have you heard of him? Have you heard of him, Lauren?
No, I don't think
so. No, I haven't either.
He was he got electroshock too, and then afterwards, I think he started to record music again late in his life. I don't know his whole story, but he was in bands in the had some hits in the 60s, and then he wrote a lot of weird music, but he was electroshocked, and then there was at some point in Texas they held some sort of thing for him, like, you know, helping Trump, because his son started to write music, and then I think they put together a kind of a thing for him that got some publicity in Texas. And they had a festival and to celebrate his music and stuff. Because I saw some posters of it, you know, and it had the electrodes on the side of his head, and they were trying to, you know, support him because he was kind of falling apart. I guess in Austin, I think, where they have it's a big music town, and they came together and kind of brought attention to that, you know, him, his music, and also the, you know, electroshock. I think that was in the 80s at some point. I think John Breeding was involved in that.
Well, we have many people that have been
Yeah.
warriors. I mean, they tried to get Lauryn Hill
Paul Robeson too.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, they did. They.
A lot of people don't realize how key the psychiatric profession was in the Holocaust. Peter Bregan has written an article on that.
Mm-hmm.
Ought to be better known than what it is.
Yeah, that's why people should really pay attention, because that's what they did first. They came after people who were developmentally disabled, mentally ill.
How? Tori wrote an article about it. Tori and Jochen, they're one of their follow-ups to Toxiplandy Gandhi or whatever it was, in 2010, the Nazi genocide, where they described the shower room that people who had been diagnosed with schizophrenia were marched into as the test chamber for the gas chambers.
The psychiatrists invented those little tricks to get people in mass numbers to go along with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they do all that.
Nazis didn't do that. It was the psychiatrists that did that.
Yeah,
between the Holocaust
and
slavery, I mean, you know, you got the shackles and everything else. All of these are these things that people are using or they use are from repression of entire groups of people. And that's what people, I don't understand. There should be a wail and a cry that goes out across the country about some of these laws and how they're like. I just think you're right. People just really don't know that there are situations now where anyone can be picked up, spirited away. Your family doesn't know where you are. And, of course, it's a trick. They want to say that HIPAA is your, they misuse HIPAA. So you can be in the bowels of someplace. I've had on two occasions people call me up and say, I don't know where I am. And they got me, you know, and there's only a couple of places in this place where they're going to detain you like that. But, you know, if you sign off. So, but you know, that can happen, and you've been there for a long time.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Catherine, did you say something?
No, who, Kevin?
No, Catherine. I thought Catherine had said something. But yeah, I mean, these are the ultimate problems that we face, and being able to talk honestly about them is not something that's happening anywhere in the mainstream media. I mean, could you imagine, you know, ABC or NBC or any of these, CNN even, or any of these organizations talking about how this is recreating things that the horrors of the past and, the you know, can't get
is there legislation now that you can see that has the same parallel? Because even in Nazi Germany, this is what people said in Nuremberg, they were just following the law.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think, you know, H.R. 3717 certainly is something that we need to watch out for, as is 4574. So the Murphy bill, you know, that will make it easier to have people institutionalized, widespread cuts in any kind of advocacy, any kind of alternatives.
What about, I've seen some clips and things with Patrick Kennedy. Why is he so vehement about, do you know anything about his views?
Yeah.
I mean, and
that
why
everybody
is he
needs
so...
Patrick Kennedy, everybody needs a checkup from the neck up. That's his call in terms, and that's his quote. Well, I don't know if it was his originally, but I heard him say it.
Yeah.
And so... he's using his own personal experience as grounds for why everybody needs to have their civil liberties stripped from them and promoting social control.
And what are his experience? You know, how he got involved in legislation for mental health?
You like to have him
I don't really know.
On?
Yeah, yeah.
I think that sometimes that people are. I think with Patrick Kennedy, I think that this came about because he saw her mental, emotional distress has affected his self.
Yeah,
his
that his own drug and alcohol was a proponent of healthcare,
and sometimes people's statements get, you know, taken out of, you know, they get the sound bite, not the whole thing. But unlike Mercy, he, even though he's not in the Congress now, he is a great proponent of health care. And I think that a lot of the things that people call emotional distress will go away if people get good health care.
Well, no, he's also, I mean, I've heard him speak in his book, A Common Struggle, A Very Personal Journey Through the Past and Future of Mental Illness and Addiction. It's coming out in late 2015. Is pretty specific that this is what he's about, and that he talks about his own, in his article I'm reading from the Washington Post. Where did it go? Sorry. I just lost my spot, but Kennedy has since worked hard to put a spotlight on addiction and mental illness and to push for the passage of the 2008 Mental Health Parity Act that requires health insurance plans and provide equal coverage for physical and mental illness. He says, I look forward to sharing my political and personal story in a way that engages everyone involved with the, quote, common struggle of mental illness and addiction, which affects us all. And so Kennedy is a big supporter of this stuff. And I know also, I think it was Amy from Colorado who has spoken about this, and through the parody stuff was wound up being involved with some of this.
But don't you think parity is a good thing? I mean, that people who choose to go and use psychiatry, you know, 10 years ago, whatever, it's still the same. They couldn't, if they were on Medicare, it only paid 50%, and where everything else paid 80%. I think it's a good thing that for those people who choose and they find value in it.
I disagree with you, Yvonne. I don't think there's anything. I think that those people who are choosing to go along with this and find value in it are doing grave damage to their bodies in the process, and are very often limiting the possibilities for their lives by accepting the limitations that psychiatry puts on them. I don't think that because it's voluntary. As a matter of fact, I think that sometimes when it's voluntary, it's worse than when it's involuntary, because what people describe to me on a routine basis is the betrayal that they then wind up experiencing when they come to and realize what's been done to them over the years.
Well, that's because they don't have informed consent. But
I think even with informed consent. Jason?
The problem with consent, from my view, is that it's just, it doesn't exist. I mean, because, you know, first of all, it's because it's based on a lie. How can you give truthful consent when the whole, you know, body of evidence, the whole body of knowledge that is psychiatry is false. So,
but then you have to test yourself. We said the other night that people choose to kill themselves, that they have the right to do it. So, you know, if people have full knowledge that,
don't have full knowledge because they're not given full knowledge, because
you
never given
full knowledge about the chemicals that they prescribe or other mechanical treatments or anything. You know, you're just not, they're not upfront about anything. And if they were, I think the majority of people would refuse, and possibly even their families, if someone is not, you know, is deteriorating or incapacitated or whatever, having, you're just not, you wind up with, you know, I mean, there are the grateful mental patients, I guess, and sometimes they write books and they make money off of it, telling the public that their treatments and incarcerations somehow saved or changed their lives.
Yeah,
but,
Stanley.
Even that, mm-hmm. I think the whole voluntary, you know, the idea of being a voluntary patient is also just not that doesn't hold water, because, you know, once you decide you want to leave, you can't, and you can be forced to into things, you know. So that's why it's so scary, and
but people do leave.
People do, as long as they're not being court ordered, and every now and then somebody gets out of a court order, and hopefully that's what will happen in John's case, and in others who are being involuntarily committed, but not always, and certainly during the time that you're under court order, you can't leave. And so, again, this is another place where, you know, issues of you know, what kind of lawyer you can get even affect the outcome of what it is you're doing. But I do want to mention that on endofshock.com, www.endofshock.com, there is a new pamphlet about electroshock, and it's called The Truth About Electroshock, ECT, or electroconvulsive therapy, Entering the Gray Zone. And there's a lot of information there that people wouldn't get ordinarily in a regular, quote-unquote, informed consent process for electroshock. But, you know, Yvonne, even if people want to take the drugs voluntarily and you know, assume the risk of the bodily damage that comes with that, that's a drug. That's still not psychiatry. And so even though, like, psychiatry, it's one of the things that psychiatry offers is a drug, you can also get that from a general practitioner. You don't need a psychiatrist for that. And so I think that the idea that psychiatry is helping people is damaging. Psychiatry looks to turn people into mental patients who that they can then say don't have the capacity to make decisions on their own. Very few psychiatrists are interested broadly in having the people that they're seeing not have to see them anymore. There's a financial incentive for the field to exist, mm-hmm. and I think the alternatives to psychiatry are much more useful and relevant than the fraud that psychiatry perpetuates. Mm-hmm. But that's just me.
You say you're not going to have insurance. I remember this quite distinctly, that you can... You know, people can. They just reluctant to leave. They can leave or lessen their involvement.
Not if they're court ordered.
I agree with you there. Not if they're court ordered.
And if they
that's why we need a larger forum, so we can develop some of these toolkits, because people do need some brochure or something, so they don't know what happens when these things happen to them.
Yeah, I mean, but I think Jason's point and what Larry was talking about last night and others have talked about is that this idea of you being able to refuse is a bell. Because,
can we
the idea that there's anything voluntary happening, because the second you no longer want it to be voluntary, it's then justifiably forced on you per their rules. So there is no real voluntary in psychiatry, because as soon as you choose not to anymore, they can tell you, well, you have to, and you don't have a choice. So your choice to do something, quote-unquote, voluntary was really illegitimate in that way. We've got 40 seconds left. I just want to thank everybody for calling in tonight. Catherine, I'm going to put this information out. If you'd like to go and support John in Ohio on July 30th at 1 p.m. at the Ross County Courthouse, you can contact Catherine at area code 614 633-0215. Yvonne, Jason, Catherine, thanks. Jason, great talking with you. Yvonne, as always. And if you have a tip or would like to be a guest on the show or know about a human rights violation that's being committed or a death that you think needs to be have a spotlight on, you can call the Talk with Tenney tip line at area code 718-273-8708. It's area code 718-273-8708. I want to thank you all for speaking out. I'm going to ask you to keep on speaking out. Until next time, talk to you soon. Good night, everyone. Good night.